and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Laura Bogart. Today, I'll be reading from the March edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. Today's first article out of the prologue section is titled, Inside the Marble Palace. As Sandra Day O'Connor retires from public life, we take you behind the scenes of her debut as the first female justice. Written by Evan Thomas. In 1981, when Ronald Reagan nominated Sandra Day O'Connor to become the first female justice on the Supreme Court, the Bulletin led every TV news broadcast and major newspaper in the county, and many abroad. The cover of Time magazine read, Justice, at last. O'Connor's confirmation hearings that September became a huge media event. There were more requests for press credentials than there had been for the Senate Watergate Committee hearings in 1973. A new media institution, cable TV, carried the hearings live, a first for a judicial nomination. Tens of millions of people saw and heard a composed, radiant, hazel-eyed woman with a broad gap-toothed smile and large hands testify for 3 days before middle-aged men, who seemed not quite sure whether to interrogate her or open the door for her. The vote to confirm her was unanimous. Nearly 16 years before Madeleine Albright became the first female Secretary of State, Sandra O'Connor entered the proverbial room where it happens, the oak-paneled conference room where the justices of the United States Supreme Court meet to rule on the law of the land. By the 1980s, women had begun to break through gender barriers in the professions, but none had achieved such a position of eminence in public power. The law had been an especially male domain. When she graduated from Stanford Law School in 1952, established law firms were not hiring women lawyers, even if, like O'Connor, they had graduated near the top of their class. She understood that she was being closely watched. "It is good to be first," she liked to say to her law clerks, "but you don't want to be the last." Suffering from mild dementia at the age of 88, O'Connor, who retired from the court in 2006, no longer appears in public. But she, on half a dozen occasions in 2016 and 2017, spoke to me about her remarkable ascendancy. At the Justice Department, the aides to Attorney General William French Smith had hoped that President Reagan wasn't serious about his campaign promise to put a woman on the Supreme Court, at least not as his first appointment. Their preferred candidate was the former Solicitor General Robert Bork. But when Smith confided to his aides that Justice Potter Stewart planned to step down, he also told them the president had said, "Now, if there are no qualified women, I understand, but I can't believe there isn't one." Smith eliminated any wiggle room. "It is going to be a woman," he said. Already, Smith had begun a list of potential justices, writing down 5 women's names in pencil on the back of a telephone message slip that he kept on the corner of his desk. As he left the meeting, Smith handed the slip to his counselor, Kenneth Starr. Glancing at the list, Starr asked, "Who's O'Connor?" Smith replied, "That's Sandra O'Connor. She's an appeals court judge in Arizona." Even though she had been the first woman in any state senate to serve as a majority leader, the Arizona intermediate court judge was not as well known, said Smith's aide, Hank Hevich. She had no constituency, with one important exception: Supreme Court Justice William Rehnquist. "Came on strong for O'Connell," Hevich recalled. "He did so privately behind the scenes. He volunteered, just popped up. This was a boost for O'Connor. It made a difference." On June 25th, Sandra O'Connor was in bed at her home in Phoenix, recovering from a hysterectomy. The phone rang and it was William French Smith. The attorney general was circumspect. Could she come to Washington to be interviewed for a federal position? O'Connor knew the call was momentous, but she answered with a sly dig. "I assume you're calling about secretarial work?" she inquired. Smith, formerly a partner at Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher, the same Los Angeles firm that had, almost 3 decades earlier, rejected Sandra Day for a law job and asked how well she could type. On June 29th, O'Connor flew to Washington to meet with the president. To maintain secrecy, she was told to wait outside a drugstore on DuPont Circle. Standing in a pastel suit, bought for the occasion at Saks Fifth Avenue, on a muggy, overcast day, She was picked up by William French Smith's secretary and driven to the White House. No one recognized her. Greeting her in the Oval Office, Reagan recalled that the two had met in Phoenix in 1972 at a Republican Party, Trunk and Tusk dinner. He asked her a little bit about her judicial philosophy and then raised what he called the sensitive subject of abortion. But O'Connor recorded in her notes of the meeting, no question was asked. She had already said that she thought abortion was personally abhorrent, but neither the president nor his men pressed her to say whether she favored overturning the 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling. Instead, the president and O'Connor chatted amiably about ranch life. Reagan seemed to be enjoying himself. After 40 minutes, the job was obviously hers. On Tuesday, September 22nd, the day after O'Connor appeared triumphantly on the Capitol steps with Senators Barry Goldwater and Strom Thurmond and Vice President George H.W. Bush, Chief Justice Warren Burger wrote his brethren. Now that Judge O'Connor has been confirmed by the Senate, we can proceed with plans that have been evolving over the last 5 weeks. The event being unique, the pressures for attendance at the ceremony and the reception and for press coverage are far beyond our capacity. Justice Harry Blackmun had already written two letters to the court's marshal, huffily insisting that his family and law clerks were entitled to their usual front row seats. Blackmun was thin-skinned and insecure, especially about his opinion in Roe v. Wade, which had become a target of the Republican right. He regarded O'Connor as a likely ally of conservatives who wanted to overrun Roe v. Wade. At a Supreme Court reception for O'Connor swearing in, a reporter asked Blackmun if he was ready for the big day. "Is it?" Blackmun snapped. Justice Thurgood Marshall was more lighthearted. He recalled that his swearing-in ceremony was celebrated with a plate of cookies. At noon on Friday, September 25th, Chief Justice Burger took the arm of Sandra Day O'Connor and walked her down the Supreme Court steps as hundreds of photographers, there for the photo session, snapped away. When Burger reached a plaza midway down the steps, he stopped and exclaimed to the reporters, "You've never seen me with a better-looking justice." O'Connor kept smiling. She was grateful to Burger and, by now, accustomed to him. O'Connor had long since determined to ignore minor diminishments. At the same time, she was perfectly aware of the importance of a dignified image. After her arrival in Washington, Sandy O'Connor, as some friends called her, increasingly became Sandra Day O'Connor. The Supreme Court was grand and imperial outside, but fusty and antiquated within. On the day O'Connor was sworn in, the elevator operator tried to go from the third floor to the second floor and missed it and ended up on the first floor. "It took him 5 minutes to get us to the second floor," John O'Connor, Sandra's husband, wrote in his diary. "We went to Sandra's office. They had just been vacated by Justice Stevens, who was moving into the chambers of retiring Justice Stewart. They were pretty bare and plain. There was no furniture, not even a filing cabinet. Stacked up along the walls were piles of paper. Some 5,000 petition requests for Supreme Court review, of which fewer than 200 would be accepted. The workload was staggering. A justice must read hundreds of legal briefs." O'Connor later estimated that she had read over 1,000 pages a day and write dense, tightly argued memos to other justices and then judicial opinions by the score. At the opening of the court's term by first Monday in October, O'Connell took her place on the bench. As the first case was presented, the other justices began firing questions at the lawyers standing at the lectern. "Shall I ask my first question?" O'Connor wondered. "I know the press is waiting. All are poised to hear me," she wrote later that day, repeating the scene in her journal. She began to ask a question, but almost immediately the lawyer talked over her. "He is loud and harsh," O'Connor wrote, "and says he wants to finish what he is saying. I feel put down." She would never feel that way for long. She was, in a word, tough. She could be emotional, but she refused to brood. She knew she was smarter than most, sometimes all, of the men she worked with, but she never felt the need to show it. The next morning, O'Connor walked down the marble hallway to her first conference with the other justices. For secrecy's sake, no one else is permitted to enter the conference room. When John F. Kennedy was assassinated in November 1963, Chief Justice Earl Warren's secretary hesitated to knock on the door. She did not want to interrupt. By custom, The junior justice answers the door, takes notes, and fetches coffee. The brethren, briefly worried that O'Connor might find the role demeaning for the first female justice, but decided that custom must go on. The court had just removed the Mr. Justice plaques on chamber doorways, but there were no ladies' room near the conference room. She had to borrow a bathroom in the chambers of a justice down the hall. By ritual, each justice shakes hands with every other justice before going out into the courtroom or into conference. On her first day, O'Connor grasped the meat hook hand of Justice Byron Whizzer White, who had led the National Football League in rushing for the Detroit Lions. "It was like I had put my hand in a vice," recalled O'Connor. "He just kept the pressure on and tears squirted from my eyes." After that, O'Connor made sure to shake White's thumb. In her journal entry that day, O'Connor noted, "The chief goes faster than I can write," and added, "It is my job to answer the door and receive messages." On the other hand, she added, "I do not have to get the coffee." Apparently, no justice had dared to ask. O'Connor was accustomed to looking after herself. Still, she was a little lonely and a little lost. As the light died on the ever shorter fall days, she would step into one of the open-air interior courtyards and turn her face toward a pale sun. She missed the Arizona brilliance. In a way, she even missed the Arizona legislature, with all of its glad handling and arm twisting. She was surprised to find that within the Marble Palace, the justices rarely spoke to each other outside of conference. Their chambers were 9 separate one-man law firms, as one justice put it. With few exceptions, they did not visit each other or pick up the phone. "The court is large, solemn. I get lost at first," she wrote in her journal on September 28, 1981. "It is hard to get used to the title of justice. A few of the other justices seem generally glad to have me there," she wrote. "Others seem guarded, not only around her, but even around each other." At the regularly scheduled lunch in the justices' formal dining room that week, only 4 of her colleagues, Chief Justice Berger and Justices John Paul Stevens, William Brennan, and Blackmun, showed up. Berger usually meant well, but he could have a tin ear. In November, after O'Connor had been on the court for less than 2 months, the Chief Justice sent the newest justice an academic paper entitled "The Solo Woman in a Professional Peer Group," with a note that read, "May be of interest." Examining the ways men behave toward the lone female in their group, the paper concluded that the women's presence is likely to undermine the productivity, satisfaction, and sense of accomplishment of her male peers. "Unless the group openly discusses her status as a woman," the paper counseled, "the woman should be willing to accept a more passive role." O'Connor routinely answered any communications. There is no record in her papers that she answered this one. She had hoped and expected to get a helping hand from Bill Rehnquist. In her journal, she regarded her old friend coolly, while noting that Brennan, Powell, and Stevens seemed generally glad to have me there. "With Bill R., it is hard to tell. He has changed somewhat. Looks aged. His stammer is pronounced. Not as many humorous remarks as I remember from years ago." Cynthia Helms, perhaps O'Connor's closest Washington friend, recalled O'Connor's saying to her, "You get there, and you're in this big office, and you have all these briefs, and Bill was no help at all." Rehnquist was arriving late to the court and leaving early. He had been laid low by pneumonia in the summer, and in the autumn his chronically bad back worsened. "And he had another reason to keep his distance from O'Connor," said Brent Dunkelman, a Rehnquist clerk, who spoke to me in 2017. "They had been such lifelong friends. He didn't want..." Dunkelman paused, searching for the right word. "Not to show favoritism, exactly, but he didn't want his personal relationship to color his professional relationship." Rehnquist knew that his brethren were aware that he had dated O'Connor at Stanford. They did not know that he had actually asked her to marry him. Blackmun did not let him forget it. When O'Connor joined the justices on the bench in October, Blackmun leaned over Rehnquist and whispered, "No fooling around." In her outer office, sacks of mail piled up. She received some 60,000 letters in her first year, more than any other justice in history. Some of the letters were pointedly addressed to Mrs. John O'Connor. One said, "Back to your kitchen and home, female. This is a job for a man, and only he can make tough decisions." A few angry men sent her naked pictures of themselves. O'Connor was taken aback by this ugly, primitive protest, but she shrugged off insults and innuendo and focused on the job at hand. Justice Lewis Powell came to the rescue. "Dad told me Justice O'Connor's secretary was a train wreck and Justice O'Connor needed help," recalled Powell's daughter, Molly Powell Sumner. He gave her a secretary from his own chambers. It was the beginning of a deep friendship with the courtly Powell. In the conference room, Powell pulled out O'Connor's chair for her and stood when she entered. O'Connor appreciated his old-school manners. In turn, Powell was impressed and possibly surprised by O'Connor's acute intelligence as well as her charm. When he wrote his family on October 24th, only 3 weeks into the court term, that it is quite evident that she is intellectually up to the work of the court. It was obviously he had been measuring her up. He added, "Perhaps I have said that she is the number one celebrity in this town." 6 weeks later, he wrote, "You know by now that we find the O'Connors socially attractive, and she is a little short of brilliant. She will make a large place for herself on the Washington scene." None of the O'Connors' law clerks doubted that she was in charge. She had no record, no experience with constitutional law, no clearly articulated views or established doctrine to follow. Yet, she did not have any trouble deciding. She was rarely relaxed, but she was almost always calm. She occasionally lost her temper, but in a very reserved way. She never yelled or screamed, but we knew who was the disfavored clerk that week, Deborah Merritt, one of her clerks, recalled. In the court's weekly conference, the junior justice votes last. O'Connor recalled that she felt electric at her first conference on October 9, 1981. On the very first case, the justices were split 4-4, and then it came to her. She felt overwhelmed to be at the table at all, and yet thrilled to be immediately in the position to cast the decisive vote. This was a power she had never felt when she was herding fractionist lawmakers in the Arizona Senate. The stakes were far higher than any judicial docket she had faced in the state courts. Behind O'Connor's mask of self-control was an exuberance, a fulfillment of her father's bursting pride. Merritt was in O'Connor's chambers when the justice returned from that first conference. "She came back almost girlishly excited," Merritt recalled. "I know that sounds sexist, but she wasn't in her stoic mode. She had found it so amazing, how they went around the table. She was surprised there was not as much discussion as she expected, but also at how weighty the issues were. And she seemed to be saying, 'I did it. I survived. I held my own.'" The O'Connor Court. The decisive vote in over 300 cases, she shaped the law on major issues. Here are a few examples. 1. Planned Parenthood versus Casey. O'Connor crafted a compromise preventing states from imposing an undue burden on women seeking abortions. 2. Bush versus Gore. O'Connor voted with 4 conservatives to justify ending the 2000 recount of presidential ballots in Florida. 3. McConnell versus FEC. Siding with the court's liberal wing, O'Connor upheld the campaign finance reform law. And 4, Grutter and Bollinger. O'Connor upheld affirmative action, ruling that race could be one factor in admissions. And 5, Hamdi versus Rumsfeld. Writing, "A state of war is not a blank check," O'Connor ruled that even enemy combatants are entitled to due process. A new order in the High Court. When RBG arrived, a supreme sisterhood took root. In 1993, when President Bill Clinton appointed Ruth Bader Ginsburg to the Supreme Court, O'Connor was relieved to have a second female justice. And not just because the court finally installed a women's bathroom in the robing room behind the bench. "I was so grateful to have company," O'Connor told ABC correspondent Jane Crawford Greenberg. Nervous lawyers occasionally confuse their names, even though they look nothing alike. The two women were friendly, but not cozy. When it really mattered, though, they helped each other. Ginsburg was diagnosed with cancer in 1999, and O'Connor advised her to have chemotherapy on Fridays so she could be over her nausea in time for oral argument on Monday. as O'Connor herself had done when she was treated for breast cancer 10 years earlier. Soon after arriving at the court, O'Connor wrote the court's 1982 opinion in Mississippi University for Women versus Hogan, an important step forward in women's rights. O'Connor's opinion was so attuned with the views of Ginsburg, then a court of appeals judge, that Ginsburg's husband had teasingly asked his wife, "Did you write this?" In 1996, the court voted that the all-male Virginia Military Institute must accept women, and O'Connor was chosen to write the majority opinion. Generously, shrewdly, O'Connor demurred, saying, "This should be Ruth's opinion." When Ginsburg announced the results in United States versus Virginia on June 26, 1996, ruling that the government must have an exceedingly persuasive justification for discrimination based on gender, and citing O'Connor's 1982 precedent in Mississippi University for Women versus Hogan, the two women justices exchanged a knowing smile. O'Connor had understood that Ginsburg would be honored to open up a last male bastion while advancing the law on sex discrimination. Ginsburg told me, "Of course, I loved her for that." This next article, written by contributing authors Sally Jenkins, Margaret Cho, and Robin Moranz-Herron, is titled "The Power and the Passion." Since the turn of the 20th century, the story of women in the United States is one of struggle, persistence, and breakthroughs. A dozen artifacts from the National Museum of American History chronicle profound changes in the life of the nation. We'll describe a few of these artifacts. Starting with the Orthonovum Pill Pack, 1963. The sexual revolution didn't start the moment the pill was approved for contraception in 1960. The usual male doctors who prescribed it in those first years often had a policy of restricting its use to women who were married and who already had children. No free love proponents or feminist firebrands allowed. Physicians at university health clinics had tough decisions to make in those early days, according to a 1965 New York Times Magazine article. Should they prescribe the pill to single girls? Perhaps. If the patient brought a note from her pastor certifying that she was about to be married? But for students with no matrimonial plans? If we did, one clinic staffer told the author of the Times article, Cornell professor Andrew Hacker, word would get around the dorms like wildfire, and we'd be writing out prescriptions several times a day. Hacker posed a similar question to his freshman class. It is hardly necessary to say that a good majority of the boys thought it was a splendid idea, he wrote. But what surprised me was that most of the girls also agreed. 5 years after that report, I became a Cornell freshman myself. By then, the world had shifted. The Supreme Court had already ruled in Griswold versus Connecticut that married couples had the right to any contraception. Another case, Eisenstadt versus Biard, was winding its way to the Supreme Court, its litigants hoping the justices would expand that right to non-married women. In 1972, they did. Meanwhile, I had had my first serious boyfriend, and we soon found ourselves in the waiting room of a Planned Parenthood clinic in downtown Ithaca. No one asked whether I was married. The physician examined me, wrote me a prescription, and soon I had my very own pill pack, complete with a flowered plastic sleeve that could slip discreetly into a purse. I stored my pills in the grungy bathroom my boyfriend shared with 5 roommates. The only time I even thought about whether my pill pack was discreet was when I went home for vacation and worried my mother would figure out I was having sex. The pill wasn't a bed of roses, despite the flowers on that plastic sleeve. In those days, it had very high levels of artificial progesterone and estrogen, hormones that could lead to blood clots, embolisms, and strokes, especially for women who smoked or who were over 35. And I suffered my share of side effects. It wasn't until I went off the pill to get pregnant that I realized I wasn't necessarily suffering from depression just because I got weepy for 3 weeks every month. It was thanks to women's health advocates that the risks and side effects of the early pill were finally recognized. Today's formulations have about 1/10 the progesterone and 1/3 the estrogen that their progenitors did. And each prescription comes with a clear statement of potential risks, the now familiar patient package insert that accompanies all medication, a safeguard that was originally a response to consumer pressure regarding the pill. By the time I got married in 1973 to that first serious boyfriend, 36% of American women were on the pill. Hacker's 1965 article proved to be prescient. Just as we had adjusted our lives to the television set and the automobile, so in 20 years' time, we shall take the pill for granted and wonder how we ever lived without it. The next artifact, Shirley Chisholm campaign buttons, 1972. When Americans first voted in 1788, only property holders had the right to cast ballots. The rationale was that only white male landowners could be truly independent. But by 1968, when Shirley Chisholm first ran for Congress, many Americans were looking for an alternative to the man, the white male leader, who drew much of his support from special interest groups. Although Chisholm was initially shunned by the Democratic establishment, she became the first black woman elected to Congress, where she represented New York's 12th District for 7 terms. She ran for president in 1972 under the slogan, "Unbought and Unbossed." A compelling statement of independence from a woman whose ancestors had existed outside American power structures for hundreds of years. Third, Grace Hopper's Nanosecond Wire, 1985. When Grace Hopper enlisted in the U.S. Navy in 1943, she had to get an exemption. The 34-year-old math professor was above the Navy's maximum age and under its minimum weight. She became a pioneering programmer, joining the team that developed the Mark I computer. After the war, she recommended that computer programs be written in English, a radical change that opened the field to non-mathematicians for the first time. As Hopper reasoned, it's much easier for most people to write an English statement than it is to use symbols. Hopper had a knack for explaining computing in ways lay people could understand. During the 1980s, she became known for handing out foot-long pieces of wire to show how far electricity could travel in 1/1,000,000th of a second. Next artifact is Big Mama Thornton's Hound Dog Record, 1953. Willie Mae Big Mama Thornton was 25 years old when the 19-year-old songwriter Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller wrote her first and only hit, tailoring it to her voice. "We wanted her to growl it," Stoller later told Rolling Stone. Growl she did, and the record sold more than 500,000 copies, helping usher in the dawn of rock and roll. A few years later, 21-year-old Elvis Presley recorded his own version, which Lieber initially found annoying. "I have no idea what that rabbit business is all about," he wrote. "The song is not about a dog. It's about a man, a freeloading gigolo." But Presley's recording went on to sell 10 million copies. To this day, few Elvis fans realize that Hound Dog started life as an anthem of black female power. Another artifact, Celia Cruz's shoes, 1997. Born in Havana, Barrio, Cecilia Cruz was barred from returning to Cuba while she was on tour in Mexico in 1960. She moved to New York, where she performed with musicians from all over Latin America and became a pioneer in the salsa scene, earning 3 Grammy Awards and the National Medal of Arts. She was known for her astonishing vocal range and improvised lyrics, and for the style that was as groundbreaking as her voice. Her wardrobe featured extravagant ruffles, sequins, and physics-defying high heels. Some of her shoes had no heel support at all, requiring her to balance only on the balls of her feet. Nanny Helen Burroughs' Cash Register, 1904. When Nanny Helen Burroughs opened a school for young African-American women in 1909, its motto was, "We specialize in the wholly impossible." Burroughs initially managed to fund the school entirely from within the black community, largely through small donations from other women. The school was unlike any other at the time. It offered vocational training alongside high school or junior college academics. Graduates entered the workforce with the skills to become domestic workers or bookkeepers, but they also had a financial savvy and independence their mothers never had. Burroughs also insisted that students learn African-American history. As she declared in a 1934 speech, "I want you to take the struggles, the hardships, and the handicaps of this civilization and turn them into stepping stones." Well, that's all the time we have for today on the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the March edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. Thanks for listening to Chris. I'm Laura Bogart. So long until next time.